Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Heads Talk with me, Elaine Pringle-Schwitter, the podcast where we talk to C-level executives, leaders of institutions and heads of multinationals. What are the current topics? They talk, we listen. My guest's fruitful career started over 30 years ago in economics and banking. He has worked in senior management and leading positions in organisations such as the International Monetary Fund, the Swiss National Bank, and the Swiss Federal Department of Economic Affairs. A highly skilled negotiator, his extensive leadership experience at national and international level. I'm looking forward to this conversation today as we dive into capital markets reform, financial literacy, and future challenges. But before we get into that, here's a message from our sponsors. This episode is sponsored by KPMG. In today's ever-changing climate, agility and flexibility are essential to maintain, grow, and understand in an uncertain world. Whatever challenges your organization is facing, we can help maximize opportunity while minimizing risk, both today and for the future. Future success means being connected to customers, to market dynamics and digital signals, to employees, to channel and business partners, and aligning across the front, middle, and back offices. We'll help you to align, to serve the customers better, and deliver greater return on investment. With deep sector insight and the latest thinking, KPMG Connected Enterprise provides a sustainable, risk-optimized route from strategy through execution with the tools, methods, frameworks, and solutions your organization needs to succeed in today's turbulent world. KPMG Connected Enterprise can offer you an insight-driven, digitally enabled roadmap to efficiency and agility that delivers sustainable growth to your organization today and tomorrow. Start your digital transformation journey now with KPMG Connected Enterprise.
Heads Talk podcast with your host Elaine Pringle-Schwitter.
PrivCap Resources Group is a fast-growing Canadian-based private capital leaders platform, facilitating access to investment insights, resources, and capital for its members. It runs senior-level forums on private equity, venture capital, and real estate under the brand name The Club Series in North America and the Euros Forum in Europe. Go Real 2021, its up-and-coming private equity real estate forum, will be held online this spring. For details, please visit us at www.clubseries.org.
Heads Talk podcast with your host Elaine Pringle-Schwitter.
Jakob Schard is a partner in the law firm Lindemann Rexenwalter. He's also a lecturer on financial markets and asset management, as well as a member of the scientific board at Swiss Capital Market Reform. Jakob has held a number of key positions in the financial sector, to include Deputy CEO, Head of Private Banking and Asset Management in Swiss Bankers Association, Deputy Head of Management, International Monetary Relations for the Swiss National Bank, Senior Advisor to the Swiss Executive Director at the IMF, which is the International Monetary Fund, and he's also been an Economic, Financial and Monetary Policy Advisor to the then Swiss President, Doris Leuthard. We're not finished yet. Jakob not only has a bachelor's and a PhD in economics from the University of Zurich, he's also multilingual and speaks five languages: English, German, French, Italian, and Russian. With his profound in-depth knowledge on government affairs and the political process, as well as financial, economic, and socio-economic policy, Jakob will provide us with valuable insights here today at Heads Talk. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Jakob to Heads Talk. Delighted to have you here today.
Nice having me. Thank you, Elaine.
You're welcome. Okay, let's start. I saw a meme the other day, very interesting meme, and it made me question the education system, and especially the education curriculum today. Yes, a large part of this should be shouldered on the parents, but it struck me as being a common sense thing to do in schools as well. It was, the meme, a list of things that should be taught in schools that's currently not. So my question to you is, do you think public and compulsory schooling is preparing our young well enough for the future and the challenges ahead? Are they, the young, through compulsory schooling, equipped to compete with their counterparts on a global level? What do you think for today and the future should be included in compulsory schooling that's not already there?
Well, I think education is very important, obviously. And in public education should prepare people for their lives in the future world. Now, if you look at how our world is changing with the rapid technological progress, which is in our time now, digitization, obviously education should prepare people for this digitization. Now, how does digitization affect their job opportunities later on? Digitization creates more jobs, is actually a job creator for high-skilled individuals. So high-skilled jobs, they will be created. However, mid-skilled jobs and to a little lesser extent, low-skilled jobs will be actually destroyed. So obviously here, this generation has to be prepared for digitization. I think Switzerland has been quite well in preparing individuals for this new world. Because we've seen that actually this technical progress has not created a lot of unemployment. Why? Because the population actually moved upwards with its education together with the challenges that it faced. So we're better off than other countries, like, for example, the United States, where the educational efforts have not moved in the same mm-hmm. way as they have here. However, I do feel that in the Swiss education system, more emphasis should be put also on really doing the things that create the value added, which is really actually programming and not just using those services. But someone has to produce them, and that's where the jobs will be. So that's certainly the case. Mm-hmm. Another thing that comes to mind is financial literacy.
Yes.
Now here with financial literacy, because surprisingly across the OECD, financial literacy is not great. And there is evidence that actually that financial literacy or illiteracy mm-hmm. enhances wealth inequality, particularly with old age wealth. There's evidence that old age wealth inequality is increased by 30-40% by financial illiteracy, or let's say financial literacy that is unevenly spread. Mm-hmm. Now, should we enhance that in school? Maybe, but we should also be aware that you can't teach everything to people who are not really interested in it. Obviously, you should find some interest. You should be able to enhance such interest. But you should also do other things. If you look at wealth, what we measuring wealth inequality and talking about wealth inequality, we are very often unaware that an important part of wealth is our old age, is the pension system. And now in Switzerland, in our three pillar system, the second pillar, which is a funded system, is for many people, especially lower skilled workers, this is the most important part of their wealth in old age. So it is important not only to teach people how to save and invest efficiently, distribute, let's say, their wealth, their income, across their life efficiently, but also to see that this important pillar of their wealth is well managed.
Yes.
And here.
Yeah. And you said interest, but I believe that whether they're interested in or not on a compulsory level, they should actually be taught maybe some of the basics of it, surely, because they will need to use it whether they like it or not. And I just think it should be in compulsory education to whatever degree that can be debated. But before we move on to the next question, I'd just like to list what's on the meme itself, and you've covered some of them. The number one was accounting. Number two was money management. Three, taxes. and 4, building and keeping good credit, and 5, picking the right career, and then it goes on, I think, up to 9, 6, nutrition, 7, self-defense, 8, time management, 9, self-confidence. However, I'm not sure about the last one. I doubt that can be taught. I'd probably be add for myself communication skills and negotiation strategies, which is in your area. And I agree with you on the digital literacy, ethics, and perhaps basic philosophy, if that's not taught already. It's just sort of opening their minds and sort of expanding their thinking. I thought I'll do that. Now, the first question that I've just asked you made me think of a problem, a forthcoming problem, not just here in Switzerland, but in other countries that I would include the UK in on this. Nobody likes talking about this, but if you are fortunate enough to live to such an age, you have to address the pension topic and your own provision. I believe there is a loophole, but correct me if I'm wrong, Jakob. There are more and more people who are self-employed in Switzerland, and that number is going to increase. Pension setup is not compulsory for them, and as a result, they're at risk for the future. What policies should be implemented to ensure that this gap, lack of compulsory savings for a pension, is addressed so that there will not be a major burden on the state to adequately manage these individuals? And to add to this, as a side question, what's going to happen to Generation X? And I believe you and I fall into Generation X in terms of the fact that we were born mid-60s to early 80s, when they reach the current boomers' pension age with insufficient pension funds.
Well, yes, I guess pensions now is an important topic around the world. We live in an aging society, and I particularly so in Europe and also in Switzerland. So, pensions are will be a challenge, and if you're talking about the baby boomers, I'm certainly one of the baby boomers, one of the last ones, which is probably the most difficult afterwards.
I thought you fall into the generation next. Maybe I'm
yes. wrong. Yes, exactly. So we're going to be, obviously, old age dependency ratios will, in the next 40 years, according to the OECD, and that's, you know, in the numbers, the demography really moves slowly, so that's pretty clear. Old age dependency will roughly double within the next 40 years. In Switzerland now, roughly 3 working people are supporting one person who is retired, and that's going to move to a little less than 2. So there certainly is a challenge here. Pensions, the pension system is being reformed, has been in Switzerland a great topic for some time. And here, things haven't moved very much in the last 15 years. There have been several attempts to move in this, but I would argue that those attempts were trying to move in 3 dimensions only, which are unpalatable for the insured, for the people who are insured in this pension system. And that is working longer, having lower pensions when you finally retire, and putting more into the system, so that saving more, basically. So these are unpalatable as such. Obviously, if demography is moving and you have the luck, the fortune of living longer, you will have to do something to be able to assure those pensions. Now, the third part, which is in a funded system, really very important, is the returns on the capital that is invested in the compulsory pension system. And I think here, Switzerland could do more and could also be moving the reforms in the right direction, putting something into the reforms that could benefit everyone, in fact. Now, of course, no miracles can be done, but managing a pension system is essentially an asset management task. And the framework for that, to be sure that that incentives are set right, that you are really able, if the system has incentives to create a performance with the risks that you would like to take, and with the guarantees in the system, to have a performance that is incentives that really enhances this performance. Mm-hmm. I think this should be more discussed in Switzerland and analyzed. Mm. Now, I am myself involved in a project who is looking at that, and we think that there is certainly something to be done in this part. This will also be enable us to move forward in a reform area that is absolutely crucial, as you said, or else baby boomers and the generations afterwards will have been paying a lot of money and being really getting the short end of this deal.
I was wondering, would you like to expand on your project if you can, or are we really still just in discussion stages? There's no steps forward?
That's a good question. No, we're not. As reform is concerned, we are still in the discussion session. Parliament is actually taking up a proposal by the Federal Council, but this proposal again only moves on the pensions, on the pensions contributions, and on the size of the pension that are being paid. And it's already obvious now that it will be quite difficult to find any solution within this, because there's just too many interests against this. So my political experience is that if you get stuck, you have to put some new elements in there. You have to, think about something that really changes this dynamic, or let's say static, because that's what it's become now. And I believe looking at the asset management aspect of the pensions would be one of those elements. We've, with a group of academics and financial market practitioners, we've done some preliminary studies last year, and we've, according to our results, just by investing the same, taking the same risk, actually 1 or 2% of additional performance should be possible. Now, why is that? As an economist, usually, if this happens, something in the regulatory framework sets incentives not in a way that really enhances performance with a given risk here. Of course, you can't. With a certain risk, you can only earn a certain performance. But according to our results, we are not there. So I think we really should look at that and look at how we could redesign the system to put those incentives right. The Swiss system is a system that has grown from a pre-compulsory system that was created by employers into a compulsory system in the last century, around the 80s. And this grown system, many elements are still the same. So really, sometimes you have to take a step back to be able to leap better afterwards. And I really think, I know it's always tough because the challenges are there. We all see them, but if you don't move, it's still better to take one step back and look at the whole system and really think how you can reform the system to set these things right. So this is what our project, this is what we've been thinking about, we have some preliminary ideas.
Does your project extend to the first thing we talked about, which is the education system?
Not directly. Well, indirectly, and I think I've just expanded. I just talked about that because the pension. Of course, the pension wealth is a very important part of the part of the wealth of the general population. In fact, for the less skilled workers, this is the most important part. So it really depends on what the performance is in that part. Now, so indirectly, I address that by saying you need to make sure that you have an adequate an adequate performance in the pension system, because you will mitigate also inequality in old age wealth. Mm-hmm.
Just as a side question, you know, if it's not within your remit, we can pass on it. But you know, Japan has a high rate of pension age people there, and they're pretty much, is there something that could be learned from there? Is there something that could be talked with from, with them on that? I don't know.
Well, I really don't know the Japanese case in particular. Mm-hmm. I must admit, but I do know that Japan had our old age, let's say the challenges of demographic aging much earlier than we had, and they understood that much earlier. When I worked for the Swiss National Bank about 15 years ago, I think, or more, I was one of those who was working for the G10. Now, probably not many people still know what the G10 are, which actually was a group of 11 most important industrial countries at the time, and Switzerland was a member of that. And I was working on a project of thinking about old age and the effects on pension at that time. And Japan, as part of the G10, was one of the very few countries that was already aware of these challenges. Mm-hmm. But I don't know enough about the Japanese reaction, the Japanese system to really expand on that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I just thought perhaps it's something we should look into. Okay, let's move to the next question. This question is really about, once again, it's still about discussions. There seems to be a lot of discussions instead of moving forward. Are we having the right discussions now for the challenges of the future? If you observe today's focus, ideals, conversations, and priorities, and the current policies and strategies to address them, and then you compare that with the challenges of the future, say in 10 to 30 years' time, population growth, new demographics, climate change issues, the wealth divide, do you think we are adequately addressing and preparing for these challenges? In fact, are we actively or passively talking about this? You know, a nation or a national or an international problem that will mature in, say, 20 years will need some major planning well before that. What say you, Jakob?
Well, I think that's a very important point right now. And thank you very much for this question. Right now, we are struggling to manage a pandemic. And it's a very serious situation. We've had a downturn that is historic, an economic downturn that is historic, and all the wealth problems that come with it. And I, in no way, I want to belittle it, but if you look at the challenges that are out there, then you really, this is really, it really highlights the importance of preparation and planning. You can see with the pandemic, with the corona pandemic, you can see this lag between putting measures into place and the effects of those measures. With corona, you put measures into place and it takes roughly 10 days until you see a first effect, which is the time it takes for the disease to break out once you're affected, at least on average. So if you are taking measures too late and you haven't been prepared for it, there is great danger of things getting out of control. We've seen this now in this pandemic. But 10 days, if you look at other challenges, is really very short. If you look at climate change, those reaction times and are much, much longer. And I think climate change is one of those challenges. Mm-hmm. If you put measures into effect, it will take very, very long for those to really have a measurable effect. That means it is even more important to put measures in place, and effective measures in place, much earlier. So I'd say, what we're going through now is a serious challenge, but it should be actually, a warning light for us how we have to prepare for much greater challenges. Just let's say much more challenges that are much more difficult to deal with in the short run, or even impossible. Mm-hmm. I believe with climate change, now we cannot only global warming plays an important role. Just stopping global warming is probably cannot be the only measure at all. We also have to go into mitigation of the effects that global warming will have. So here, I think clearly plan always meets always beats no plan. So ever so often, if you have challenges that look to be far away, even if the reaction channels are very long term, it's very difficult to get on the same page. if you look at climate change, we haven't really been able to put into place agreements and measures that have really made a huge difference. So this is a huge challenge that we have to think about it. And this is, you know, many of the measures, these measures really have to be thought about in a whole system. It's not just, stop growth. You cannot get out of the realities in this world. But there are ways to integrate the cost of the climate of the external effects in a way that incentives would put make sure that we care more for the environment and the long term effects that will be very, very difficult to turn around.
Indeed, and I sort of suspect that in taking action now for a problem that's going to happen in 10 to 20 years' time, the government of the time probably don't want that in their budget and expenditure and having to justify that. Let this continue with the global theme and look at Switzerland's position on the world stage. A straightforward question, I hope. Switzerland has had a long-held position as the negotiator between various powers. In the last 10 years, how has Switzerland's position changed, would you say? Has its influence waned or strengthened, and why?
Well, it's pretty obvious that the influence of Switzerland has waned. I mean, I was talking about the G10 earlier on, and the G10 no longer exists. There we were very important, obviously, yes. And our importance is not that big anymore. Now, the world has changed, and Switzerland is, I think, really struggling to find a place here. I think a big change for Switzerland was the end of the Cold War, which, of course, everyone was very happy to see this end. However, since I perceive Switzerland often like being in a permanent identity crisis. Where do we belong? We don't belong to the European Union. We don't belong, of course, not to US. We're kind of on our own. And that makes things difficult, obviously. And it's very hard to have an influence in such a world. Anyway, in general, I believe as a medium power like Switzerland, a multilateral system, international system is the best thing for a country to be in the of a medium power like Switzerland to be able to have an influence and bring its influence into the world. But you know, it's true. We have to think about these things. How can we, what is our angle? And here, how can we increase our weight? How can we punch at our weight again? Because I often feel that we don't punch at our weight, but below our weight.
Have you got any ideas?
Well, yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. Obviously, this is difficult, but at least we should start discussing now. I think if we, in our generation, we won't see us joining the European Union. So we have to find a place somewhere different. And I think here, you know, the interesting thing with Switzerland is I sometimes also have the impression that we vacillate between a totally unwarranted inferiority complex and hubris. In the first instance, we feel we have to submit to any pressures that comes upon us, mm-hmm. and in the other, we feel we can bring a global hegemon to its knees. So we have to find a better way here. Mm-hmm. I think this means really thinking about new alliances, other alliances, also unconventional alliances. So we have to start thinking about that because I say unconventional alliances also because in international relations, there are no friends, there are interests. And here somehow, it's not that people, that Switzerland is being pushed out. It's just that our importance compared to others is not the same that it has been before.
Could Switzerland perhaps use new technologies? Its stance in digitalization in the digital space to bring them back to the place they were in when they were very influential pre the Cold War, as you say.
It's certainly part of the our economic power, which is considerable, I would argue, and that's where we are very often much too close to an inferiority complex. I think, yeah, this is certainly an area, but this is an area that, in fact, anyone should invest. If you look at the economy, I think we're pretty well placed. However, you know, if we look at financial services, mm-hmm. I'm not always here. Again, I'm not sure that we're punching at our weight. We're punching below our weight. I think we've been a center traditionally of banking, and we're an important yeah. financial center, no doubt about that. But I do think that in the traditional financial sector in Switzerland, digitization is not moving as quickly as in right. as in other countries. And I, you know, for example, asset management that I know well, a lot of things are done in a much better way by algorithms. So digitization here is extremely important. It's not just the digitization of convenience, that yeah. you can look at your wealth, how it develops. That's all nice. But you know, the more complicated things, how you should allocate your different assets, including, let's say, real estate or whatever you have. Those things are, you know, very much facilitated with digitization. I don't think we're doing what we can do there yet. And if you look at neobanks in other countries, they're not necessarily being created here. They are created elsewhere. Yeah, I think digitization is important. Is it important to regain a place on the political scene? Well, it certainly is on the economic scene. this is a must, that's mm-hmm. for sure.
Okay, all right. So there's still some work to do. Okay. Staying with the international scene, I want to briefly talk about the US election, the recent election of Joe Biden. I think one thing we've all noticed that it's quieter than the previous administration. Nevertheless, how does the election of Joe Biden change the dynamics on the global stage? Will there be changes to the relationship between China, Europe, Russia even? What are the implications for Switzerland? You mentioned Switzerland needs to develop new alliances. So it'll be interesting your take on this.
Yes, I think there's really a lot that is changing. And I'd like to, with the presidency of Joe Biden. I think there are two things that actually belongs to the same phenomenon. Joe Biden is a multilateralist. I think he's really showed that most clearly when with his decision to rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement right away. So he's a multilateralist. I've talked about that earlier. For a mid-sized power like Switzerland, a multilateral system with global rules is the best way to be able to bring yourself into those decisions and be part of the decisions that impact our country very much. So that's for Switzerland, that will That's a good change. I'm convinced. You were talking about China. Well, China is probably one of the things that the relationship between the U.S. and China is probably one of the things that will not change very much from the administration of former President Trump to the administration of President Joe Biden. So that's probably something where general interests will be more important than the personal way to address it. So for what does it mean for Switzerland? Multilateralism, as opposed to former President Trump's transactionalism, is certainly good for Switzerland. If you look at the specific chances, opportunity, that the relationship between the U.S. and Switzerland that concern the relationship between Switzerland and the U.S. My mind comes to the free trade agreement that has been negotiated for some time, or let's say envisaged between the two countries. Here, a free trade agreement between the two countries is nothing new. Actually, at the beginning of this millennium, there have already been negotiations, but they stalled, or to put it more distinctly, it's Switzerland that actually abandoned that effort. Mm-hmm. I've always been a friend of the idea of a free trade agreement with the U.S. Mm-hmm. because it's such an important power after the European Union for Switzerland. Here, I think actually it would have been easier with President Trump to find an agreement, but even with him, because he didn't think in the same categories of power blocks and the important and the alliances that the US now with this administration and historically after the Second World War has been thinking. Here, Switzerland, for President Trump, that was an advantage, probably, that Switzerland wasn't part of the bloc, and in his world,
but
that would have been an advantage. But Joe Biden, we're just probably not very high up in the priority list.
Okay.
Looks like he has other priorities right now.
You said it would have been an advantage to negotiate this budget agreement while Trump was in power in administration, but it did stall, doesn't it?
It stalled. It did stall. Before, yes.
And then when Trump was in power, it stalled. So was it an advantage, really?
Well, it didn't turn out to be sufficient. It's just, you know, I think the administration of former President Trump was also quite unpredictable. It looked like an opportunity, but in the end, it didn't work out. I think it should still be pursued, and I think the U.S. is generally interested in having free trade agreements. But here we have to be realist that we're probably not, well, we're on the priority list somewhere. Yeah, but I mean, even before the administration of Trump, I've heard we want that, but it's not, let's say, high up on the priority list. And I think here it's especially important not to succumb to hubris. The U.S., if it negotiates free trade agreements, they have a certain template agreement on their mind, and there are also content challenges content-wise here. And I think of agriculture. I've been discussing with representatives of the U.S. about that when I worked in previous lives.
Mm-hmm.
Not that long ago, and they said, look, agriculture, the way Switzerland has a particularly protected agricultural market, and that is difficult for the U.S., and let's say that's difficult to find an agreement. Mm-hmm. Here, something most probably has to move for us to be able to have an agreement here.
Okay. Let's look at capital market reforms and the Activity Act. In 2009, the Swiss government decided to comply with the OECD standards for tax-related queries. What is your take on the Swiss financial markets after these developments? Is the bank secrecy dead, or are there still some loopholes which are being explored to circumvent this transparency? And what is, or was, the impact of the financial marketplace?
Well, first, the impact of this change towards a transparent, fiscally transparent financial world. I think that Switzerland has managed very well. The Swiss financial sector has managed very well in changing to this new world. And this was, I would say, this was not obvious because, you know, fiscal considerations were just not important if dealing with clients before, mm-hmm. because it was not something that is in the realm of between, it was not something between the client and the bank or the financial product supplier to discuss that. That has changed dramatically. And it has also changed focus on the performance of the service itself. I think we haven't seen assets flowing out of Switzerland in the way some people were thinking that would be possible. So Switzerland, certainly the financial sector certainly managed that quite well. You also ask, well, do we have fiscal transparency now? Yes. Aren't there loopholes? Well, we have a global standard now, an OECD standard on the exchange of information on tax matters, automatic exchange of information, and almost everyone adheres to that standard. Well, there is one notable exception, that's the United States, which also has a financial transparency, fiscal transparency law, if you want to call it that way, which is called FATCA. But essentially, FATCA is unilateral. The U.S. Gets all the information, but the information doesn't flow automatically the other way. So there is a loophole, certainly, and it's an important player. Mm-hmm. But in general, I think this is a new world. It's a tax-transparent world where focus will be more on the performance of the financial service itself. And that is a very different world, and I think so far, the Swiss financial sector has done that well. I mean, there was this myth that everything was just about taxes, mm-hmm. and with the Swiss financial center, that's most obviously not true. It was never clear, always clear that was never the only element in the success of the Swiss financial market. But now this is obvious. But it's a new world, and we have to reorganize ourselves in this new world. If transparency also enhances the possibility of comparing for the clients to compare what you get from your financial service provider. And so, yes, but this is competition. That's good, Coming back to digitization, I think that's one of the elements that will decide on whether you get a good financial service or not, mm-hmm. and whether a client is happy with that. And the choice will be more obviously more obvious for the client. And so pressure and the importance of keeping up and providing excellent service has really increased.
So Switzerland has adapted quite well and seamlessly.
I think it has adapted quite well, but it's really no time for complacency. I think, as I said before, I think in digitizing, we're not at the forefront. We're not terrible, but we can still do more.
Okay. Right. I'm fascinated by this last question, and I'm looking forward to your thoughts on this. I've called it déjà vu, and the listeners will understand why. It's about the current pandemic or the end of it and what will happen thereafter. Naturally, we will be in a reflective and celebratory mood and perhaps have a period of growth excessive growth even. At the turn of the 20th century, there was an economic boom at the end of the Spanish flu pandemic, the start of the Roaring Twenties, as it was affectionately known, and the subsequent stock market crash, and then the Great Depression thereafter. What are your thoughts on the potential for another boom and bust, history repeating itself? Are we actively monitoring this so that we don't have a repeat of the history, or are these two totally different circumstances?
Are they totally different circumstances? Probably not, but they are not the same either. I would think, does history repeat itself? I don't know. It doesn't repeat itself, but it certainly stutters. So we should be preferred. We should be prepared not to do the same mistakes we did before. I think a few things are different. It's true. We're coming out of a pandemic. Well, at least I hope that we're still in it. We're still struggling with it. We've had the financial crisis that ensued after the pandemic and after the First World War was roughly 10 years later. We've seen a financial crisis with similarities to that crash like 10 years ago.
2008 crisis. Yeah.
Some of those elements were certainly the same. We had an asset price boom, arguably a bubble. We had a banking system that didn't cope well. Well, Switzerland actually coped better than in other countries, and the financial sector crises that start in the financial sector tend to take much longer to iron out than other economic problems. So we've kind of had that crisis already, and financial institutions, at least banks, are much more resilient than before the financial crisis of 2008. So I think this is an element that will not be exactly the same. We will hopefully have a bust, boom. What am I saying? We'll hopefully, have a recovery, a recovery after this horrible, after this pandemic. We'll see how this will pan out. And obviously, there are challenges there, and are they the same? Well, the pandemic in 1918. When was the last?
Yes, 1918
or 1919 was the last wave. Well, already the timing of the financial crisis isn't the same. So, well, we'll see how it pans out.
In a way, it's sort of the same. The Spanish flu had three waves.
Yes.
We're going for our second.
Yes.
And if absolutely. We have a third wave, I think we need to sort of hold on to our seats here. A thought, would we need to have a task force, I don't know, in the financial sector, just to make sure and monitor that we don't go down that road? Because, you know, as I said, with the history repeating itself, it was a major crash, and the depression that came afterwards wasn't very pleasant. So just thought
that's true.
Something that they should look into. Hey, thank you so much for a fascinating discussion on Heads Talk today. Jakob Shah,
thank you.
Thanks my for pleasure. Your time and insights.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks for joining me today on this episode of Heads Talk. Don't forget to subscribe to the show via my website, elainepringle.com/Heads Talk, or wherever you get your podcasts. Finally, I'd like to thank our sponsors, guests, and you for helping to make the show possible. Please join me next time, where I'll be featuring more executives, decision makers, and heads of multinationals.
Heads Talk podcast with your host Elaine Pringle-Schwitter.